configuration management and how it works in the program. And then you might say something later on about safety. We're interested, you know, in the overall scope of the Saturn program. We're going to talk about the overall management of the program and interfaces between contractors and MSFC and headquarters. And we're going to talk about funding and scheduling problems. And since Roger and I are both historians of technology, we want to talk about some of the hardware used, welding problems, handling problems, new technology, engines, hydrogen, all these hydrogen handling problems, this kind of stuff. And so, you know, we'll mention these various types of management structures that are overlaid over the whole situation. The Air Force philosophy, we talked with Mr. Greer last week, and I've read some books on functional management, what have you. Now, I'm not a management expert, but I think I can, you know, dance through it in half a dozen pages. It's fairly confusing to the readers. And I'd like to also talk about configuration management as well in there. Okay. So this is kind of a new thing with the aerospace industry. Probably came in, didn't it?
Yeah, configuration management was really an Air Force innovation. And it came into the Saturn II program about 1964. And what had happened was that NASA had written a document known as NPC 500-1, which was the Apollo Configuration Management Plan. And in 1964, they decided that we ought to have something like that on the S2 program. And essentially, configuration management is a management system that provides you visibility and control of the hardware as it's built, so that you can assure that it's built the way it was designed to be built. And it's a control system. Starts out with engineering identifying what it is in terms of drawings and EOs and specifications and so forth that they are going to prepare, and that is an estimate, you know. And then they put this on a what we call an engineering product plan, and that is in a computer, and that's released. And then manufacturing, as the these drawings and specifications are released, manufacturing then immediately upon release receives a copy, and they start their manufacturing planning right to the drawings and to the specifications. And they have systems within manufacturing that are reporting systems that show that a certain job was planned, and it tracks it all the way through manufacturing until it's completed and installed in whatever next assembly, if it happens to be this end item or the stage, why tracks it all the way through to that point. And from the time that configuration management is imposed on a program, it should really be back during the design phase. There should be some, we didn't do that on this program, but in the design phase, configuration management should be imposed in engineering, so that there is some degree of control of changes that engineers make to the design as they go along. Now, there's, when you release the design, any design, whether it's a small component or a large end item, or when you release the design and you start to manufacture it, obviously there's going to have to be some adjustments in the design, because it's everything doesn't fit together. The kind of change control that should take place on a program in design at the onset is one where the engineering department controls their engineering design changes, so that they, when they do make them, that they assess the impact on schedule and cost, as well as the need for the design change. If they do that, then we will be better able to control costs in, on future programs, I believe. We didn't do that on this program. We started in 64, and that was probably 3 years after the contract was let. And so it's configuration management kind of jumped into the center of the program, maybe after the program was about 35%, something like that, on its way. jumped in and tried to enforce disciplines into the functions that were difficult to enforce because people were used to operating kind of freely. But we did it, and with great pain. And we have now a system where design changes. First of all, let me say that we baseline, we do a baselining. You design an item, you manufacture one of them or two of them, and then you test them and assure that the design is, you know, proper and the equipment is working and so forth as you intended it. And then you go in and you do a complete drawing review of all the specifications, all the drawings, all the paper. And that's called a baseline of the design. And you say, you make a mark and you say, from that point on, any changes that you make, engineering design changes that are made, have to be processed through a design or a change control system. And what happens is that they assign what we call a uniform control number. That uniform control number is placed on every engineering order that's released against that particular design change. It's placed on all of the manufacturing paperwork and so forth, so you can identify the total change package. And before you proceed to implement the change, what you do is we go to through several change control boards. We start out with a project engineering change control board, and the chief project engineer chairs these, and he says, that's the first gate, if you will. He says, yeah, this change looks like it has merit. Don't think it's going to have much effect on the schedules and costs, so we'll allow it to go through this gate. And the next thing is they do an engineering change control board number two. And at that board, more detail is presented, and they also get inputs from the other functions as to whether or not it impacts them, manufacturing primarily and test operations. If the change still appears to have merit, and in other words, in some cases, we hope it's mandatory. After you baseline, any changes thereafter should be highly, highly, highly desirable or mandatory. Mandatory from the standpoint of accomplishing the mission or the safety factors as well. Okay, it goes through the engineering change control board gate number two. And there, from there, that point, it goes to the program manager's change control board. So there's three gates it has to go through, and it goes to the before we even propose it to the customer. And that change control board is the program change control board, chaired by the program manager, and a representative from every function sits on that board: manufacturing, quality, safety, test operations, engineering, configuration management, business operations, and so forth.
How long would that take?
Contracts. How long does the...
Between one meeting, gate one and two, would that be normally a week? And I suppose it depends.
It usually runs about a week from the time a change is identified by an engineer or an engineering design group to the time it gets to the change control board for the program. It usually takes about 30 days, roughly 30 days. And unless the change is so urgent that we would call special, convene special board meetings, but a normal change is processed in about 30 days. At that point, at the program change control board point, the program manager will approve it either to submit it to the customer, or in previous years he had the prerogative of approving it to proceed what we call across the board. In other words, he approves submit to the customer, he approves that it we release the engineering, he approves it to start fabrication and procurement and actually installation. Now, he needed that flexibility early in the program in order to handle problems that occurred because of design. Mm-hmm. and the problems cropped up either in manufacturing or at Seal Beach here in our test operations area. After manufacturing receives it, it goes to test operations where they do a test of all the systems. And then from there, it went to Mississippi where we did a static firing to prove the engines, essentially, as a cluster, that they operated properly as a cluster of engines, because each engine is already static fired before we receive it. But as a cluster, it is, they aren't.
No, you test as a cluster.
We test as a cluster at Mississippi.
Not Rocketdyne. They just fire it.
That's right.
See that goes.
The engines, oddly enough, North American Rockwell Space Division and Rocketdyne are, you know, same company. But oddly enough, the engines are supplied to the Space Division as government-furnished equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So they're totally separate contracts. We receive the engines individually, and we receive them static fired, tested. Then we install them on the stage as a cluster, and when we get them to Mississippi, we cluster fire, just to verify that all the systems are hooked up right and everything's working properly. And in the early days when we had problems in the static firing operation where the parameters of pressure and temperature and duration of firing and so forth weren't exactly meeting the requirements, why the program manager had to have the flexibility of making changes that were necessary to bring them into the requirements, up to the requirements. So that was in earlier years. Now, there is no change that is processed, and they're all processed through this change control system. There are no changes that are processed where the program manager approves full implementation of the change prior to the time that the customer sees it. He approves the change to be submitted to the customer for approval. The customer then receives it, judges it, and if they approve it, they send us back a change order authorizing us to go ahead and proceed. So as you progress through a program, the controls get tighter and tighter. But you do need the flexibility. You need the configuration management, because if you don't have that, you're going to be totally out of control. Engineers, bless their hearts, are inventors. And you don't want to stifle their inventiveness, but at the same time, you do have to control some of it, because if you don't, there are other things besides being innovative that are important, like schedule and cost. And if you don't impose some sort of a control system on them, that controlled in the sense that you don't stifle their inventiveness, but you make them go through certain checkpoints and orifices and so forth to prevent them from just arbitrarily making changes on their own judgment that may affect all kinds of things downstream, why then you really get out of control, no doubt about it. And that primarily is why they decided to put configuration management on S2 in 1964. And we were in a cost overrun condition, and so we imposed config management.
How far does configuration management go back? Does it come out of Schriever's office or with the ballistic missile programs? Said it was Air Force.
Yes, yes, it does. I don't recall exactly which program the Air Force first implemented configuration management on, but it was quite a few years ago. What problems they had were logistics problems. They thought they had spare parts in many cases. This is in the airplane days. I shouldn't say airplane days. They still build airplanes, but the days before missile boosters and all that kind of stuff, they thought they had spare parts, interchangeable and so what have you, in stock in their logistics warehouses, and they'd go to pull them out when they'd have a failure and put a spare in, and it wouldn't fit. And yet it had the same part number on it and what have you, and that's part of configuration management, is part number control. whenever you have a part that has a certain configuration, it has a part number. The part number is either usually a drawing number right off the drawing. And if you make a change to that, that causes that part to no longer be interchangeable in its fit or function, you must change that part number. Well, they had parts in their bins that had same part numbers, but that in fact were not interchangeable. So they said, hey, we got a lot of money tied up in this stuff, and we can't use it, and so we need to invent some system of control, and that's where configuration management started. In those days, it started right out called configuration management. Now, there usually is a contention by all the people that don't like to be controlled that configuration management is costly, and I disagree with that. It's only costly if people won't conform, if people will go ahead and do what the system tells them to do in a disciplined manner. It saves money, actually, on the program. And I can say that at this point without being parochial or prejudiced, because I no longer am in configuration management. But I do believe it. I guess probably at one time I was the worst violator. That I was in engineering, I was a project engineer, and whatever it took to get the job done is what we did. And I guess what you do is you hire the thief to control the other thieves or something, you know. So, but I sure as heck became a firm believer in it.
Did you have any exchanges of information and configuration management with the people at MSFC, like Don Bowden, for example, and some of these people that worked in the field, or John Aberg? Did Aberg do some work in this?
Actually, Don Bowden had been the resident manager back here, mm-hmm. In California, and he, about the time that I came on the program, in early 64, John went back to Huntsville, and he didn't then get into the configuration management business more in the area of automating and computerizing, if you will, the data system of configuration management that they now have back at Marshall. And that's the only interface I had with him. I had, other than that, very little. Another guy that has contributed greatly to configuration management on the Saturn program is a fellow by the name of Stan Wade, who is a NASA employee. He's a former Air Force, either a lieutenant colonel or colonel, I can't recall, and has retired from the Air Force and has been with NASA. He's been on the S2 program as long as I can remember. And
is he here?
He's at Huntsville.
Huntsville, okay.
He's kind of a brilliant guy, you know, and he's a tremendous management systems designer, you might say. And he was really the one that got configuration management off the ground back in Huntsville. That's my opinion, anyway. I think he's probably the one that's most instrumental in it. And we have a system now where, especially at Cape Kennedy, where we have a complete closed loop. When an engineering change starts through the system, at the time that it's incorporated at the Cape, because that's where all of our stages are now, we know precisely when it's completed, and we have records to show it, because we have down there a closeout card. It's called an INC card, installation notification card is what it stands for. And that card says change number 83472, you know. That's one number more than the uniform control number has, but anyway, that change is now complete. And everybody signs it off and away it goes.
Does it show for each vehicle that haven't been launched?
Each vehicle, it shows there's an INC card for every change on every vehicle.
I see. So So you've got 10 vehicles, the 10 cars come back.
That's right. It's change 1, 2, 3, 4, stage S214, stage S212, and so forth. And of course, each of those changes, even though they're the same modifications to each stage, those changes get incorporated at different points in time, depending on the particular schedule cycle of the vehicle. And that information is then fed back to the Huntsville computer, and there's a tab run that says, you want to know about change so-and-so? Yeah, here's when we first initiated it, and here's the life cycle of that change. And here, yeah, it's complete, or no, it isn't complete yet on a particular stage. And I don't think that you can afford not to have that kind of visibility in programs where you're talking about manned spaceflight, where you have to have vehicles, spacecrafts, and so forth that are man-rated.
If these numbers all have gone in numerical order, how high are they now? How many changes?
Let's see. We've got 6,941 is being introduced today.
Okay, now that's since 1964.
Right.
15 vehicles.
Yeah.
Plus the test vehicles.
Plus the test vehicles, yeah, S2T, S2S, S2F. That number is a little bit misleading, not too much, but there have been, of course, out of all that, upwards towards 7,000 numbers that have been reserved for changes, many changes have been disapproved.
Yeah.
And so the number is retired.
Yeah, well, it'll give a real rough idea
right.
What we're talking about.
What is this total changes, 6,941?
41.
Those are the ones that have actually been made.
No, those are
the ones proposed and have gone through the system.
Yeah, right. And yeah. Of the
few of them have not, didn't get through.
Yeah, I'd rough guess,
10%.
Oh, I'd say that 10% would be what,
700?
Yeah, 700 to 1,000 probably, somewhere in there have been disapproved, never implemented, and the number gets retired, like I say, so we don't get mixed up or confused. You can always, you know, numbers are cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you have any other questions? Configuration management? We can move to safety if you'd like.
Maybe we better.
Okay. Okay, system safety. Very few people know what system safety is. And I've been on a campaign, I've been on a campaign, a year. I've been in the director of Saturn Launch Vehicle System Safety for about a little over a year now, about 13 months roughly. And I've just in the last 6 months started a campaign to apprise everybody that I can get an ear from what system safety is, but primarily the people on the program, the engineers, the managers, and so forth, the program management staff and what have you. A lot of people think because the word safety is there that it means hard hats and band-aids. Well, safety is a many faceted I guess you could call it management system. We do have industrial safety, and industrial safety is primarily that which is concerned with people, with the injuries to people and the operation of facilities. And when I say facilities, I don't mean necessarily manufacturing facilities, or I'm talking about buildings like office buildings and what have you, that make sure that the designs conform to the codes of the state and the local governments and so forth, and that they are constructed in a safe manner, and that they, if in our case, so we have a lot of subcontractors that come in and do work here, not only in construction, constructing the initial facility, but we have them come in and, like, wash these windows, for example. And an eight-story building we're sitting in, you know, we're on the eighth floor, and here comes a guy down alongside the building washing the windows. And they have to have certain kind of tethers and so forth attached to them so that they, well, industrial safety worries that side of the house. All industrial injuries, scratched fingers, broken arms, or whatever, those are all investigated and followed up by industrial safety. Those are reported into our medical department, and a form is filled out as to who the guy is, where he works, what happened, and all that kind of stuff. But system safety is, although it's somewhat concerned about people safety, it's mostly hardware safety. It's a really closer to a systems engineering than it is to anything, because system safety starts, and I have to say that Air Force again was the one that initiated system safety, primarily because of accidents they'd had in their aircraft, takeoff crashes, landing crashes, explosions in midair, and so forth. But on a total program, through a life cycle of a program, from concept phase, definition phase, design, fabrication, test, and operation, operation being the launching operations and the total operation, say, like at Cape Kennedy. System safety gets up above all of that and looks down and says, if you do it right, that is, and looks down on it and says, okay, I get involved in the concept phase, and when I'm talking about the concept phase, I also start thinking about what happens in the design phase and the manufacturing phase. So you've got continuity all the way through in this overlook. And system safety is in the concept phase is primarily a function of identifying what we call gross hazards. And gross hazards can be anything like, yeah, there's going to be nuclear fuel used, so therefore there's radiation hazard. And we're going to dock in space, so there may be some docking problems. Yes, we're going to refuel in space, because many of our programs now are like space station, for example, and the shuttle, where we would use an orbiter. We would launch it, put it in orbit, and we would refuel in orbit. We might put an S2 stage in orbit full of liquid hydrogen, and we would do the refueling there in space. Okay, that's a gross hazard. The docking, the refueling, how do you handle the cryogenic fuels in space, and so forth. What kind of maintenance and requirements are there for the particular vehicles? That's a gross hazard analysis type thing during concept.
Does safety people do this?
Safety people
or
do that. System safety.
Or the engineering people, or both?
Well, both. System safety developed the gross hazards, and system safety now has people in all of the disciplines. We have system safety engineers in engineering. Mm-hmm. They not only do the analysis, but they assist engineers in doing the analysis, the hazard analysis, and the hazard prevention design techniques during design phase.
How many people are involved, or were involved at the peak?
Well, I'm going to have to answer that. Let me defer that, and when I get to the history of it, you'll see why I do that. In 1967, the Saturn program decided that they better have a system safety office. And that's 1967. That's not to say that we didn't have system safety on the program. Like I said, system safety, if you ask any system safety engineer or expert, will say that system safety is planned to be performed and manned through the whole life cycle of a program. But in the Saturn program, we really didn't emphasize safety until 1967. We had some one or two system safety engineers in engineering, and their role was primarily as a consultant to design groups. And when you're talking about 50 design groups and maybe 500 engineers, two system safety engineers can't be very effective. Ideally, in the concept phase of a program, you'd have somewhere in the vicinity of three or four safety engineers in engineering, and during the design phase, probably half a dozen. And then in manufacturing, you should have at least one